I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The writer Pico Iyer joins me now. He has just published The Man Within My Head, a deeply personal book about his lifelong fascination with the writer Graham Greene. As the title suggests, Greene figures prominently in the head of the British-born, California-raised son of two Indian scholars. He's a sort of father to Iyer. He never met Greene, but through Greene's writing, Iyer's own life is revealed. It's a fascinating, wonderful book. We'll get Mr. Iyer to tell us about the book, Greene, and his own life illuminated through Greene's work. Pico Iyer is a writer noted for his travel writing and his books on the Dalai Lama, Japan, Cuba, and globalism. He regularly appears in the New York Review of Books, the Financial Times, Time, and the New York Times. The website for more is at picoiyerjourneys.com. The book is published by Knopf. Please welcome to the Planta Online program here in Vancouver this day, Pico Iyer. Good morning, Mr. Iyer.
Good morning. Really nice to be here.
Thanks for joining us. So how do you explain this book? Is it a memoir? Is it a biography of Greene? A manual of, I guess, being a son of sorts?
Well, I love that last category, and I think all of the above and none of the above. And as you can probably tell, I tried really hard to create something that wouldn't fit into any category. So it's not exactly a memoir, and it's sort of a counter-biography, and I don't even know if it's fiction or non-fiction. But I did feel that Greene made a lifelong habit of not settling into any group or community or category, and I've done some of the same. And so I thought to do justice to that, I would have to create a form that didn't naturally settle in any place and kind of hovers between different kinds of category.
See, when one reads the book, one wonders if this is, well, I guess it is homage to Greene and the part he's played in your life, but it also seems that the book was for you and that you wanted to work out something, and I'm wondering what that was.
Well said. Yes, I think I almost deploy Greene, or maybe not even the real Graham Greene, but the one I've constructed in my head for my own needs, as a way to look at things that perhaps it would be hard for me to see otherwise, because I relate to him so strongly, at least in his books, that I feel I can see myself in those books, and it's always difficult to kind of stare at one's own navel and see what's going on there. But once it's externalized, once you feel you can see some of your tendencies or patterns in another person, then you can perhaps look at what otherwise you would fail or try not to look at. So you're right. I think you mentioned in your introduction that he's a kind of father or a shadow father, a ghost father for me. And so looking at Greene was also a way of thinking about my real father, whom I've never really much written about or addressed in my thoughts. So Greene was, I suppose, yes, a convenient mechanism, like a flashlight, to go into those darker passageways that I would otherwise not venture into.
What was your own relationship with your father like?
I think benign, but one of the formative things about my life was that I went to boarding school in England while my parents were in California from the age of 9. And so really, I grew up with and at my school much more than with my family, and came to know the people around me, my classmates, with whom I was sharing a roof 24 hours a day, much more than my parents. And I think the book is not so much about me and my father, but maybe more about fathers and sons generally, and that archetypal pattern that all of us know, whereby when we're young, in order to create ourselves and forge our own identity and create our own destiny, we have to turn our backs on our parents and make ourselves up as often the opposite to them. And then as the decades pass, suddenly you look in the mirror or hear your own voice and realize it's very familiar and realize that you've in some ways turned into your father. And you rebel against your parents until you become your parents. And so it's a little bit about that growing up on the far side of the world from my father, attaching myself to Graham Greene as a kind of alternative father, and then halfway through my life realizing, well, in spite of that, or maybe because of it, I'm very much like my father.
And so Greene, I guess, connected you to your father. The writing of this book did.
I think so, exactly. More the writing of this book than Graham Greene himself, because I think when I began the book, I was pretty sure that Graham Greene was the man within my head, to invoke the title. And then the more I continued looking at Greene, the more I wondered if my father wasn't that man. And I guess when I was growing up and going back and forth between California in the 60s, where my father lived, and a 15th century English boarding school, which is very much Graham Greene's world, I really saw them as opposites. And Greene was almost the caretaker of my English identity, and he spoke for skepticism and tradition and the things that I associate with those ancient schools. And my father spoke for revolution and the future tense and the mystical world, things very different. But the more years have gone on, the more those distinctions have dissolved a little, and I see how much both of them were really dealing with both of those extremes, with the constant dialogue that many of us have between skepticism and faith.
And so does the real Pico Iyer, then, does that emerge?
Well, that's a good question, and I think maybe not. I think I've been telling my friends that, remember that in this book I didn't include a subtitle, and that's a way of saying that this book is not typical nonfiction, and there are parts of it that I don't necessarily believe. I've always thought that memoir is a kind of fiction, and that we're least to be trusted when we're speaking or indeed writing about ourselves. So I would say it's a very good portrait of my life. I'm not sure how much a portrait of myself it is. I think a writer is in some ways a little like an actor, and what you do to play the part that will carry any book is to go into yourself and find one tiny corner of yourself that you can stress and impersonate and project to the world. And you use that part of yourself as a kind of narrative device. But I think that's only a tiny part of the whole picture. So many of my friends, for example, have said, we didn't even know you were interested in Graham Greene, even though they've known me for 30, 40 years. And there are other influences I have, or men within my head, that I could have followed in order to write a very different book. But I thought Graham Greene was a good way to excavate some of the more difficult parts of myself.
The book is also a catalog of these coincidences that you have in your life and that you share with Greene.
Mm.
When did you first encounter Graham Greene?
I first encountered his writing when I was in school, and like many a schoolboy, I was told I had to read The Power and the Glory when I was 13, which made me determined never to have any interest in Graham Greene and never to like him. And above and beyond that, my mother was a great fan of Graham Greene, so I had two reasons not to like him. He was a favorite of my mother's, and he was being inflicted on me by my teachers. But I think as soon as I began to travel, and I think many people have this experience, I came to see that no writer had caught the beauty and sometimes the predicament of somebody alone in a hotel room in a very foreign country as Graham Greene had. So I think the more I traveled, the more Greene became my constant companion on the road. And the more, as you say, I found that I was almost walking through a Graham Greene novel when I was on the streets of Havana or Saigon or Haiti or many of the places that he wrote about. So initially, I was interested in those coincidences and convergences, and then I had to ask myself, what lies deeper than this? What is it about his particular sensibility or way of thinking or doubts or fears that speaks for a more mysterious kind of connection?
When you travel now, like you're in Vancouver today,
mm-hmm.
Is Greene with you?
Less so in Vancouver, but I think if I were in one of the cities that he made his own, including the ones I just mentioned, he would be very much, and maybe even here, he's next to me in some invisible way, because I'm always thinking about how much do I believe, what do I do when I walk down the street in Vancouver and a homeless person extends a hand, what is the kind thing to do, to give him money, not to give him money, to give him something else. And I think those are the questions, the riddles of kindness that face you when you're traveling around the world, that Greene really occupied more than anyone. So I think he might well be all around me. And as it happens, this evening I'm doing an onstage conversation with an old friend of mine who's Graham Greene's niece.
Yeah.
So he's literally going to be almost with me on the stage.
So you're referring to an event that the Writers Festival is putting on with Louise Dennis.
Exactly.
When you talk to Louise, do you talk to her about Greene?
I have. Yes, I have over the years. And, of course, she's been both a wonderful friend and editor to me, but also a great guide to to those parts of him that the world doesn't know, because her mother, Elizabeth, was, I think, Greene's closest sibling and typed all Greene's letters for many years and really was his great confidant for most of their lives together. And when Louise's mother died, Louise's sister, Amanda, took over that position. So Louise is as close to Graham Greene as anybody could be, and has given me a wonderful picture of the private man, great fun and beloved by his family.
What does she make of this relationship that you have with her uncle?
Well, I shouldn't speak for her, and I should say that I think the whole Greene family has suffered for a long time from so many people who never met Greene creating their fictional or imagined Graham Greenes and feeling a strong connection with him. As I was writing my book, I ran into 7 or 8 other books by men, women, English people, American people, all about being haunted by Graham Greene. And I feel sorry for him, and I feel sorry for those who know him, because so many of us strangers make use of him. In terms of this particular book, when I met Louise a couple of weeks ago, and she was very kind and didn't seem to flinch too much at the liberties I took, but I don't know how she really feels about my use of Graham Greene, except that I think she knows and acknowledges that I'm not claiming to write about the real Graham Greene. It's just the one that I've invented.
See, I know of Greene, but I've never read any of his books. And I guess this is really the first time that I've really gotten to know who he was and read up about him. I did watch The Quiet American the other night in preparing for all this. Is that the book that's your favorite?
Exactly. When you began that question, I was going to say, really the best thing to do, maybe even ideally before reading my book, is to read The Quiet American, because it's such a rich distillation of who he was and what he was doing, because as you know, having seen the movie,
yeah.
It was written and set in Vietnam in the early 1950s, and in the early 1950s, Greene was already writing about napalm bombing and CIA intrigue and American operatives trying to find local allies, all the stuff that really only began to happen, it seemed, 10 years later. And he tells a story about the English Empire, represented by an Englishman who mocks America because they realize that America has become the new power, and Asia, represented by a Vietnamese woman who kind of shimmers between these two but plays them off against each other and will always remain outside the grasp of both. And yet, even as he's telling this great political public story about the three empires, British, American, and Asian, he's also telling this really rending private story about three individuals just wondering how much to love another person and how much to be on their guard. So he tells a public story, a private story, he knits them all together, and it's in fewer than 200 pages. And the final thing I'll say, since you mentioned the film, is a nice example of what a prophet he was, because that film starring Michael Caine was, and the great Canadian actor Brendan Fraser, I think it's one of Brendan Fraser's best roles,
yeah.
It was screened for its producers on September the 10th, 2001, and then they couldn't release it for more than a year after that because it was so close to the headlines of later that week. I think if you want to know what's happening in Afghanistan next year and what just happened in Iraq, the best source is this Graham Greene novel from 1955.
So what I've seen and read of the Quiet American is that there's a lot of Greene in Fowler, the character that's in the movie that I saw is played by Michael Caine. So I guess the more difficult question is how much do you see yourself in Fowler?
Well, Fowler is a middle-aged English journalist and in Saigon. And I have been a journalist, and I certainly am of middle age now, and I was born and grew up in England. But I think what really gives that book tension and excitement and surprise is the fact that, as you say, when you begin reading it, you assume that Greene is the middle-aged Englishman.
Mm-hmm.
And then as I read it, I begin to, and the middle-aged Englishman is always mocking the young American who's just arrived in Saigon out of Harvard and is determined to remake this ancient culture in the light of his textbooks and in the light of young America. And Fowler is always mocking the young American. But as I read it, I think the young American is really a part of Graham Greene, too. It's who he was when he was young and innocent and chivalrous and idealistic. And the middle-aged man is only mocking the younger man because he he sort of wishes that the younger man's chivalry and quixotism and idealism were still in himself. And so I almost see it as a dialogue between two different parts of Graham Greene, the innocent and the world-weary middle-aged man. And certainly I can relate to that, and I think all of us can. Every time I travel, a part of me wishes I was still 19 years old and did all the crazy things I did without thinking twice about them when I was 19. And a part of me is glad to have learned a little over the last 35 years and to have a better perspective on life than I had when I was 19. But I think all of us are that confounding mix of the wide-eyed ingenue and the sometimes disillusioned older person. And we're always trying to ask ourselves how much to give priority to either one.
The other idea that people have of Greene is this Catholic writer.
Yes.
Which is, I guess if you read up on Greene, is I guess it's his faith, I guess, is part of his life and a part of his writing. Is that something that you've thought about, and I guess whether you're religious or not?
Yeah, I think so. I'm fascinated by the complications and the paradoxes of faith. And just as you say, Graham Greene was a Catholic writer who claimed not to believe in God. And what that meant was that the questions of faith were very alive in him. He hadn't settled into the resolutions that either a believer or a non-believer settles into. He was going back and forth between those positions almost every day, I think. And he had a very keen sense of goodness and saintliness and innocence, and yet he also felt that he could never acquire those qualities himself. So it's both agonized and poignant and invigorated that he's always aware of the ideals that he can never quite reach. And in my own case, I was born to Hindu parents, and I went through Anglican schooling, and I live in Buddhist Japan. And I've learned a huge amount from my friends who are fully settled into those faiths, and I've read up on them and really steeped myself in their wisdom for a long, long time, while also, like Graham Greene, being not very good in settling into just one of them. And so I think I do relate to him. I think it's important to think about what goodness and kindness mean, and it's important to think when you're in a foreign country and somebody asks you for a favor, what is the moral thing to do? But I don't claim to have an answer, and I don't claim to have a single textbook. And that wavering quality in Greene probably is something I connect with.
And in Greene's writing, he talks about, I guess, the worst tendencies in his life, sort of the dark side of himself. He was a writer that sought redemption in his writing. In this book, and through your study of Greene, are you searching for redemption too, and what for?
Not necessarily searching for redemption, but searching for clarity and honesty. And I think the two sovereign virtues I associate with Greene are kindness and honesty. And I think any one of us, whatever we believe or don't believe, is the better for having those in our lives. So yes, I love the fact that Greene challenged those tendencies that were strongest in himself. He loved to travel. He wasn't very good at committing himself to a person or a place. And all his novels, as I read them, cross-questionings or challenges of the fact of travel and challenges against people who don't commit. And I've known that sensation, as you know, in the book. At one point I'm sitting in Bhutan in a little hotel room where I'm staying for 3 weeks in the middle of winter, and the electricity goes off right the way across the whole city and maybe the whole country. And all I can do is read Graham Greene's novel, The Comedians, by the light of the gas fire, these two glowing orange bars on the floor. And as I'm reading them in that darkness, I am thinking that the questions that he's posing to his protagonist in that book, he might be posing to me. Why am I in this foreign hotel room in a country that has no connection with me? Why am I not with the wonderful new love I've just discovered in Japan? Why am I constantly moving from place to place? And I think for me those are good questions to ask. And as a traveler, the first thing I want to do is interrogate myself about why I'm traveling and why I'm not staying put. So Greene has been a way for me to ask those unsettling questions of myself. And as I say, I don't claim to have answers, but I think they're worth addressing, because especially now I feel we're living in a very polarized continent and world. And it's very easy to kind of remain surrounded by people who share your assumptions and to remain very fixed within and hostage to your own tendencies. So somebody who comes in to the room and asks you to think twice about all the things that are second nature is doing you a great service, I feel.
I in the middle of watching The Comedians, the movie, did you like that movie?
I'm not sure I've ever seen it, actually.
It's Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor.
Yeah, I haven't seen it.
I'm doing this, I guess, to introduce myself into Green after reading this book, which this book makes me want to do, I guess.
Good.
Was that what you wanted in writing
the book? Absolutely. If it's got you reading his books or watching the movies of his books, I'm thrilled. That's the main thing I would want, probably.
Say, has your mother read this book?
She's just in the early stages of it, and she actually happens to know certain details of the stories that I include that I didn't know, so I've actually been very grateful to her for pointing out that some of the little vignettes I include are much richer than I'd imagined, and I'm going to include larger sections of them, I think, in the next edition.
So you've been traveling throughout the continent selling this book. You live in Japan, right?
Right.
Yeah. Do you identify with that place because you live there?
I do. I think Japan is my secret home. When I was a little boy, I would always read Japanese poems or look at Japanese paintings and feel this unexplained, piercing familiarity. I felt that I knew this culture better than I knew the street on which I was born and grew up in Oxford or the house where I was living in California. And amazingly, even after I went to Japan, that sense of kinship survived. So it's a place where I naturally feel at home, and I feel that there are many qualities there having to do with attentiveness and compassion and selflessness that I want to learn and that are worth learning. So I'm very settled there, and my mother's still in California, but if she weren't, I think I would be in Japan the rest of my life.
And I read somewhere that you're going to Iran shortly.
I am, but I'm worried that my editors may be cancelling the trip. Again, Iran is the second culture I've been fascinated with since I was a little boy. Just mostly the aesthetics, the poems, the carpets, the miniatures, the pictures of the mosques I've seen. So I've long wanted to visit those magical places like Shiraz and Isfahan and Mashhad. And all being well, I'm due to go next week as soon as I finish traveling with this book. But I'm more and more thinking that my editors are going to ask me to postpone it until things have quietened down a little. And I've got to say, when I say that, yeah. I think you were about to say something about The Comedians, and I might have cut you off. Were you going to say...
No, I wasn't.
Oh, just that you were watching the movie.
Yeah, I was just watching the
movie.
Yeah,
and I sadly haven't seen it.
Yeah. I downloaded it on iTunes, so...
I see.
It's got a great cast. It's got Peter Ustinov and Alec Guinness. Lillian Gish is also in it, so...
And Alec Guinness is one of those characters who often appeared in Graham Greene movies. I think he was in Our Man in Havana also.
What for you, was The Quiet American, the newest version of that, was that the best Greene movie?
There's a very good version of The End of the Affair made by Neil Jordan, the Irish director,
right,
who's also a writer, with Ralph Fiennes in the lead, and I think that catches the shadowy, slippery, double quality in Greene very well. The whole movie, as I recall, is kind of shot in the mist and yet has that passion and intensity pulsing just beneath the surface. So I think Greene recently has been well served by his films. When he was alive, he couldn't stand most of the films based on his books and said that they were made almost to discredit or to hurt him. I remember when The Quiet American was first made, in, I think, the 1950s, the Vietnamese woman was played by an Italian woman, mm-hmm. and the American, who's kind of the villain of Greene's book, was played by a war hero and turned by the American filmmakers into a hero, and so Greene really felt as if he'd been hard done by.
How do you think your father would have reacted to this book?
You're asking very, very good questions. I think he would have been taken aback by it. I hope he would have been touched by it, because in some ways it's about my trying to find the human quality in my father. He was a very, very charismatic, almost larger-than-life character, and I never knew him very well while he was alive. And in this book, I'm trying to recover those parts of him that seem wistful and poignant and instantly deserving of sympathy, not just admiration, but something closer to home in some ways. So I hope he would have seen that it was about my trying to understand and get closer to him now in his absence than when he was alive. It's interesting, my mother turned 80 last year, and I threw a little party for her, and some of her friends suggested that I interview her at the end of the party, and I didn't necessarily think that was a great idea, but I did suddenly realize it was a great way to ask her the kind of questions I'd probably be too shy to ask her in real life, as it were. And so I asked her, now you've completed 8 decades, what is the main lesson you've learned? And she said that you can never know another human being. And I was really taken aback by that, because it was the last thing I expected my mother to say, which showed that I didn't really understand her, even though I've known her every day of my life. Mm-hmm. And when she said that, I also heard it as a son, of course, and thought, well, maybe she's saying she doesn't understand me or doesn't understand my father. So it was a resonant, very Greenian line, and a surprise for me to hear, and a useful reminder, I guess, of one of the good lessons I take away from Graham Greene, which is that not just that we don't understand other people, but that we presume to understand them, and that's really the problem, that we assume that we know them inside out, and we make great judgments on the basis of that, and in truth, we probably should be more agnostic, and just the way that Greene always admits that he doesn't really claim to know if God exists or not, I think he would say he doesn't really claim to know how the people around him really are, and I think that's a salutary reminder.
Mr. Iyer, this is such a wonderful book. I could talk all day to you about it, with you about it. Congratulations on continued good luck. I've really enjoyed the conversation today.
Thank you. Well, I so appreciate your really searching and thoughtful questions. And we're having such a good conversation, I too feel we could keep on for a long time. But I really appreciate your interest in the book, and thank you for reading it, even though you hadn't been interested in Graham Greene before.
Thank you very much. The website for more, PicoIyerJourneys.com. The book is called The Man Within My Head. It's published by Knopf. Its author, Pico Iyer, on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.